This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, of Liking and Loathing, how to hook your readers on your characters.
So this week was actually suggested by Jules, and yet I watched something yesterday which has made me super pumped for this discussion.
Yeah, I obviously we've talked about characterization and things before, but we've never really talked about how you get someone to want to follow your characters in the first place.
Yeah.
Now, I don't mean what I'm about to say to be discouraging, but when you start off writing before you build an audience, there is no reason on earth why someone who doesn't know you would want to read what you've written.
Yeah.
So, I mean, part of that is being able to, writing something that your target audience would want and then finding your target audience. And part of it is then keeping their attention by giving them characters that they can root for and relate to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's why using archetypes, you know, or selling things with archetypes works so successfully, because people already feel like they know that character, they can relate to that character. But it isn't just about that.
No, definitely not. So, yeah, once again, this isn't meant to be discouraging. It's actually quite a good thing, because you're starting from the position of someone being not invested in your character at all. Yeah. Therefore, it's a blank slate, and you can do whatever you want with that.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's worth mentioning fan fiction at this point. I think part of the reason fan fiction is so popular is because it caters to various niches,
mm-hmm.
but usually with characters that are already established and have canon, and people want to see more adventures with those characters. So it's a writer manipulating somebody else's creation in a way that other people want.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is ultimately the probably why a lot of people find it much easier to read fan fiction than they do to start original fiction, even people who really love reading. And it's simply because that first big hurdle, the first big battle of getting to know a character has been done for them. They already know this character. Even if they then have this character set in a completely different world, you know, completely different setting, with completely different lives, they already know the character. Even if the character then themselves starts to sort of be quite different, they know the character already, so they've had that introduction. And because they've had that positive introduction, they don't need to put in the work. Because that's the other thing to remember. When you are introducing a character to a reader, they actually have to put in the work as well as you in order to create a connection. It's you know, a two-sided thing. Now, what you want to do is you want to make that process as, you know, as smooth, as streamlined as possible. You want to give them a reason to fall in love with your character, whether they actually like them or not, but you want to give them a reason to fall in love, to be engaged with your character as quickly as possible.
Definitely. So if you think about the premise of your story and your initial setup and things, that's the hook. Mm-hmm. And your character is the bait. You want tasty, tasty bait that makes the reader just swallow the hook before they even realise they've got it in their mouth. To use an angling metaphor. But that is the general idea. You want them hooked. You don't want them to escape.
I'm sorry. I have to take a minute.
That's fine. I went a bit darker and weirdly more Girl's Guide to Hunting and Fishing rather than wanted to.
So it's just the tasty, tasty bait. Okay.
It's really fun living in my head, let me just say.
Jules is a frightening person sometimes. Okay, all right. I'm calm. Please continue.
So, our aim today is to show you how you can create characters people will engage with.
Yes.
We're going to start off with the question of likability. Mm-hmm. There's a big debate that I don't think is ever really going to get solved to anyone's satisfaction about whether your main character, or indeed any of your characters, need to be likable. And I think part of the issue here is that people assume likable means that the character is someone you want to hang out with in real life. Mm-hmm. So conventional likability. Now, while that might be the case with some characters, that's not what narrative likability is about.
No.
Narrative likability is having a character who is ideally the perfect balance between being someone your reader wants to follow and root for and someone your reader occasionally wants to be.
Yes. I think it's also worth noting that, once again, it is possible to have a character who is not a good person in this respect. And in some ways, the reason that your reader follows them is that they kind of embody the sort of darker aspects of humanity or provide a sort of catharsis which, you know, would never translate to the real world. For example, I have my character, Aaron, from the Hamashia cycle. He is an assassin. I'm just going to say flat out, he is not a good person. If he was a real person, I'd want to definitely make sure that he was in prison. He's dangerous, he's cruel, he's just quite nasty, to be honest. And yet, some people have already said he's their favourite character. He's a character that they can get along with because he is enjoyable to read. People like his sense of humour. They like the way he speaks, even though it doesn't make any sense to any, you know, living person. They like the fact that he sort of embodies all of the sort of the inside things that you want to do, which is that if somebody pisses you off, you punish them. He, you know, there's an opening where he's essentially working in retail, sort of. He's running an assassin's business. And I think that anyone who's ever worked in retail can just be like, yeah, I too have wanted to murder annoying customers. Not seriously, but, you know, like as a form of catharsis. Therefore, he embodies that aspect. He's likable in that sense. He's not likable in a real world sense. And that's the distinction that you need to make.
Yeah, I mean, it's like characters like Mia Corvair from Nevernight, who is an absolutely amazing character. But at the same time, if you really think about what she does, she's definitely not a white hat.
No.
At all. So yeah, you can have lots of characters who are neither nice nor good nor particularly moral, and yet they're still compelling characters that people feel a genuine engagement and connection with.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's okay if your character is a bit of a shit. I'm just going to put that out there. It is okay for characters to be shitty people. The point is that they have to be shitty people in the sense that there's something still relatively likable about them. It's like another good example, Deadpool. Deadpool is a bit of a shitty person. Let's not lie.
He's a contract killer.
He's a mercenary. Now, people have sort of been made to feel like, okay, we can sort of get on with him because he seems to have a little bit of, you know, a bit of morality there. But at the same time, there's only so much morality you can have when you are a contract killer. And yet, as a character, he's likable because he's funny, because he breaks the fourth wall, because he's enjoyable. And that's okay.
Yeah. So, as we've said, there's a difference between conventional likability and narrative likability.
Yeah.
And if you happen to be writing a not-so-great person as your character, they have to be narratively likeable.
Yes.
They don't have to be likeable, as in, yeah, let's go down the pub and have a round.
Yes.
I want to hang out with you.
You don't have to want to hang out with your character. Well, in real life, you might not want to hang out with your characters at all.
I will say that there is a lot of value in new writers learning to make a character conventionally likeable as well as narratively likeable at the same time.
Yeah.
Before they go on to write a darker character
yes.
that isn't conventionally likeable. It's just basically part of the whole learn the rules before you decide to completely break them, throw them out the window.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the thing, though. It is also worth noting, when it comes to this debate, that there will be people who have varying opinions. Now, for example, for me, I don't tend to get on with unlikable characters at all. I will really struggle with them. Again, I can have character. I can write characters like Eren because he is. He's a side character. He's a little bit of fun to write. He's a bit of a bit of an experiment. I can even enjoy characters like Deadpool because he does have that slight moral compass that kind of dictates what he's up to, and all of the people he seems to be killing all seem to be incredibly bad people. Therefore, you can kind of get away with it. But whilst there are other, you know, people who can get on with characters who are quite detestable, and just feel like, yeah, but I can like them because they're fictional, I personally can't get on with them. But that is a very personal thing, and each of your individual readers will have personal things like that. So just because a couple of people have said, no, that character isn't likable enough, doesn't mean that you've got it wrong. It just means that it might not be for everybody.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously, again, remember the difference between conventionally likable and narratively likable.
Yes.
So, as a personal example, technically, if we went back to the 14th century and you actually met my character, Gregory Maudsley, in person, you wouldn't find him conventionally likable by the mores and standards of the time. He's really not a white hat. I mean, one of the first things he does is hunt down a bunch of thieves who've, like, beaten him and left him for dead.
Yeah.
Now, while that's sympathetic, he doesn't spare any of them.
No.
That's not a moral thing to do. What he should have really done was, you know, enlisted the help of the local lord, captured them,
mm-hmm.
and sent them through justice, because there was a criminal justice system, even if it was a little bit, you know, different to how we would understand it today. He doesn't, but I will say that, you know, even people who have kindly taken the time to tell me that they don't like their books have said they really like the character. I'm like, yeah, I designed him to be narratively very likable to people, although if you examine his actions by the standards of the time, he's quite unconventional and also not really likable by the standards of the time in a conventional way.
No, absolutely. He's also he's not very fashionable. That sounds really stupid, but he's not a fashionable character.
He's not at all. It's the whole, I mean, yeah, I was playing with Chaucer's idea of the Knight's Tale and the fact that the knight in the Knight's Tale was really not behaving like a knight should at all. And no. This is basically what Gregory does. He does not behave like a knight should. He does not sort of engage in tournaments just for the sheer joy of it, to show off the flower of manhood kind of thing.
Yeah.
He does not, you know, he will dress to the station because he has to.
This is the flower of manhood, Gregory just mumbling, flower of manhood.
Yeah, he's not a fashionable person. He's not a great intellectual.
Yeah.
And he's not one of the savage brute knights either, so.
No. I think the thing which really works about Gregory, though, is that because he's not likable in the period that he sort of exists in, he has qualities which we would consider likable today. So I'm not saying going out and hunting thieves and murdering them is likable, but the fact that he just wants to stay home with his wife, that he just gets on with his wife, and he has a good relationship with his children, and that, you know, he believes in teaching his daughter how to fight and, you know, stuff like that. These are all things which are likeable to the modern day, but to the era that he was in as a likeable character, increamably unlikable. This was not something that would be done.
No, we have accounts where certain fathers in that situation, husbands and things, were a bit more like that.
Yeah.
But it was unusual, and it was unusual to prefer the home life with your wife and children and your farms and things over political advancement, for example.
Yes.
Or going off to battle.
why aren't you kissing the king's ass? Come here, come to court. Why are you spending all your time in the middle of nowhere?
Whereas Gregory's kind of like, oh god, there's another bloody war, I suppose I'll fight in it because I have to. The sooner I capitulate, the sooner I can go home. And I'll get left alone.
He's very, what's the word? Relatable. Ugh, fine, but I'll complain the whole time.
Basically, yeah. So it's... The illustration there is that, yes, you can have someone who is conventionally likeable to us now and is narratively likeable, and yet they would not be conventionally likeable in the time or setting that you've put them in.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, that is a very popular trope, particularly with things which are set in the past, is to have characters who are unlikable within the context of the time that they're living in, because actually they are, their morals, their direction, their actions are much more in keeping with modern standards instead. And it's actually how a lot of authors and creators make their characters likable to the audience, whilst also demonstrating that the characters would not be likable within the context of the world that they're living in.
Yeah. Exactly. So, how do you make a character likeable in narrative terms? There is no one easy bake answer for this. There's no Betty Crocker, like, cake in a box type thing going on.
Well, frankly, now I'm disappointed.
But there are things that you can consider doing, particularly if you're just starting out. I think the thing is, some people get character immediately, and that seems to be where their access point on a story is. So everything that they've read, everything they've watched, or plays they've been to, it's the character that grabs them. And some people are more sort of plot or setting driven.
Yeah.
And it takes them a little bit more to get their feet under the table for character.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's nothing wrong with that. A good place to start is giving a character a relatable flaw and then starting to build around that. So if you're someone who does not have characters just turning up in your head, fully formed, carrying their luggage and their backstories, then you can start with...
Hello, Mother, I have arrived.
Yes. Talk about me! I swear mine are there with, like, protesters with signs and things. Yeah, create a relatable flaw. So something that you can basically go, what do... What would be the best character to tell this sort of story? So, sorry to bang on about the King's Knight, but this is one where I genuinely did actually create the character from the ground up rather than having them just arrive.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I created Gregory from the ground up was because I was commissioned to write the books.
Yeah.
So I knew roughly what the story was going to be and when it was going to be set, who was the best character. Well, probably a knight, but not somebody who was too well off, because then he wouldn't have very much to struggle against.
Yeah.
Unless I wanted to make it a story about political machination only. But then, again, that's further to fall, but that's not as far to climb. So
yeah.
It was swings and roundabouts. And I wanted to show the peasant side of things as well. So having someone who only just scraped into the nobility was a good compromise.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's sort of like where he was in the social strata. Okay, what would that make him? Why is he now entering this particular struggle in history now? Where has he been before that? And all these things sort of give you the idea that, well, he hasn't been home in 10 years. Why not? Didn't get on with his father and brother. He's been off selling his sword. So already he's not a very moral character because he's been working as a sellsword for 10 years on the continent.
Yeah.
He's already someone who's willing to bend the rules significantly.
Yep.
And then, okay, what's his most relatable flaw? His most relatable flaw is he doesn't like people, but he feels compelled to act well anyway.
That's my favourite thing. So what's his most relatable flaw? He doesn't like people.
Yeah, doesn't like people, really just wants to be left alone.
But does he actually want to be left alone?
He thinks he does. So it's that sort of idea. And I mean, I'd had a very limited word count on the first book, even though I overshot it very slightly. So, I mean, I literally kind of did these things. I looked at backstory, so I've just talked about his backstory. I didn't just go, oh, here you go, here's a chapter of his backstory, so you know about this guy. Mm-hmm. Here's the introduction. I drip-fed bits of it in mm-hmm. all over the place.
Yeah.
I've never really, on the page, explained what the conflict with his brother and father was. I've left it to the reader's imagination.
Yeah.
At this point in time, I know what it is, but I didn't. There was no need for people to know it. They just need to know there was a problem there and that his brother was an abusive arsehole kind of thing.
Yeah. I know some of it.
You do. Madeline's seen things that other people have not.
When you say it like that, Jules.
That sounded really, really bad. That sounded so better in my head than it did out loud. So there's that backstory you're creating, and that's creating sympathy, because who of us have not had someone in their family that they have difficulty maintaining any sort of civil relationship with,
yeah,
or have had a troubled relationship? And then there's the whole sort of being the second son, being quite overlooked,
mm-hmm.
and then not being able to do things as quickly or as well as his older brother.
Yes.
It doesn't go into detail, but it's hinted at.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I do like, though, is that Gregory doesn't even realise that he did do something better than his... He achieved one thing his brother completely failed to do, you know, other than, you know, living. And yes, maintaining an estate and running it successfully. He also managed to marry the woman that his brother wanted to marry.
Yes, yeah, he doesn't... I don't think that's ever really come up in conversation.
No. It's just, ha!
So there you go, relatable flaw, backstory, creates sympathy. There's humour there. There's humour in the fact that he's constantly being put upon, even though he doesn't like people, and he's compelled to help them anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. He is incredibly relatable in that way. Because he is a noble, but he's so low down, he kind of exists in, you know, the same sort of circle that most of the modern readers will be living in today, which is that working because they have to work certain things, you know, yeah, having to deal with certain people, particularly difficult people who are more privileged than them. We've all been in that situation with a manager who tells you you have to do something, or someone turns up and says you've got to do something, or you're like, oh god, the rent is due, I've got to go and, you know, work an extra shift, yeah, or things like that. These are all really relatable things, which makes Gregory immediately likable. You could have absolutely done a story of, you know, political intrigue and things like that, but ultimately you've got the political intrigue and the heavy relatability of just being a person who's got to do a job that he doesn't particularly want to do.
Doesn't want to do it. I finally inherited everything. Oh, but everything's up shit creek because my brother's just spent all the money and then died and left me with it. This isn't a boon, it's a burden kind of thing.
Yeah.
The other thing is that, you know, they talked about screenwriters showing a character saving a cat. So you establish early on that someone is the character to root for, if you like, yeah, even if they're not a particularly good person, by doing something good or something that makes them seem very redeemable.
Yeah.
So Gregory does have a save the cat moment, but it's not a cat, it's a young orphan.
My little heart just exploded with delight just at the sheer thought of Cuthbert. My angel. But,
I mean, his save the cat moment is very much done in a very Gregory fashion. In the sense of, to say grudgingly, shall we?
I love the save the cat moment because it's really done because Gregory wants to piss off the guy who he's saving the cat from, as it were. I keep saying, yes, the cat, but yeah, it's just like, I could leave this child, but I kind of want to see the look of anger on this blacksmith's face when I take him instead. And it's very successful.
Yeah, and obviously it echoes the whole sort of like, Gregory was bullied by his much older brother, and now cannot stand to see other people acting in a bullying type way.
Yeah.
To someone smaller and weaker.
Exactly. And again, this is another real level of relatability that we see, because he, in some ways, Gregory, despite the fact that he is in a position of power, he has been the underdog.
Yeah.
And so he fights for the underdog from a position of, you know, I can't speak, Jules. He can relate to Cuthbert, and thus he, you know, fights to protect Cuthbert. And that is something else, because I think everybody, no matter, you know, who you are, no matter whether you yourself were a bully, most bullies have been subject to someone else's bullying as well. You know, everyone has experienced bullying to some degree in some level at some time. Obviously, some more than most, which is another thing which makes Gregory as a character very relatable. We love someone who fights back against the bullies.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the thing with, you know, having this, you know, I really made the most out of this save the cat moment, this save the child moment, because yes, you get that echo of Gregory's past. You also get him doing, Gregory literally doing his save the cat moment. And then it feeds into relationships. And relationships is another item in the sense of how a character relates to other people helps define who they are. And in real life, how you interact with other people will change and shape you. And it should do. And it's the same for your characters on page.
Yeah.
So if Gregory had just gone, it's not really my problem, felt a bit uneasy about it, and then concentrated strictly on sorting his estate out, but left Cuthbert there, he would missed out on quite a bit from the benefit of having Cuthbert sort of in his life kind of thing.
Yeah.
And in some senses, that would have directly affected the plot, because it's Cuthbert that sends Gregory after someone else who he, again, doesn't really want to help.
just as a thought experiment, at one point, Jules and I did plan out what would have happened if he hadn't met Cuthbert. And it doesn't go well, actually.
No, it doesn't go well. I mean, it's affected lots of different things, including his ultimate, more cordial relationship with his wife.
Yes.
It was an arranged marriage and they did not like each other initially at all.
No, it was, yeah, it wasn't a warm relationship to begin with, I think it's fair to say.
No. But there you go. That, again, that's relationships. So, I mean, Gregory's main ones, certainly in the first book, Cuthbert, Chaucer,
mm-hmm.
someone who would have been an unlikely friend for a knight who basically has dyslexia, even though they didn't have the term for it back then.
Yeah.
The king, obviously, and his wife. Those are his real four main relationships in the first book.
Yes.
Oh, and there's Fletcher as well, the old family retainer, but he's almost like a placeholder for the past.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and again, that is the big thing. That is the ultimate thing. In that we are actually willing to forgive a lot of things in a character if we see them having some kind of relationship with someone that we feel is, you know, nice. It's like people forgiving Snape, for example. They want to forgive Snape because Snape loved Lily. And that's the only saving grace apparently people can think of when it comes to Snape. Book Snape, well, I should say, rather than
Book Snape, definitely.
Snape.
Yeah, it's quite easy to get dazzled by Alan Rickman, isn't it? In the sense of he's a great actor and gave us a very relatable version of Snape.
He did. It was also there's one bit where film Snape would also occasionally show dazzling moments of actually being truly brave and kind. Like there's a great shot when Lupin, werewolf Lupin, transforms, and there's Snape yelling at the kids. And when he sees the werewolf, he grabs the kids and he puts them behind him. You know?
Yeah.
Which is not something that I think book Snape would have ever done.
No, despite the fact that he felt compelled to keep Harry alive because he'd essentially made sure that his parents would die, kind of thing.
Yeah.
As a more extreme example, obviously, a lot of people say Kathy and Heathcliff from Wuthering Heights. And it's like, those two really don't have much in the way of redeeming qualities. It's just this epic love for each other.
Yeah.
I personally don't find that makes them likeable, but I do find it makes them, well, not conventionally likeable, no. But I do find it makes them interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. It does make them engaging. And that's the big thing. They have that one particular link which people can really appreciate and see the kinder part of a character. And people will cling to that. It's also a little bit like Loki in the first Thor movie, right?
Yes.
Tom Hiddleston does a great job of showing Loki's small moments of vulnerability. And those moments of vulnerability, his relationship with his father, his relationship with Thor and things like that, and with his mother in particular, as we get into the second movie and stuff like that, they all really tie into the build-up of this character, who is otherwise a bit of a shit, let's not lie.
Yeah, it's a kind of a masterful switch there. He goes from being, like, public Asgardian enemy number one to, like, actually he's one of the boys kind of thing.
Yeah, like, absolutely. And it's very interesting the way that they do that. I think it works very successfully, and it's one of the reasons. And again, Tom Hiddleston really has obviously contributed to that, I think, because he didn't just want to have a very sort of two-dimensional character. He wanted a character who had agency and a reason for behaving in the way that he behaved. So I thought that was done very, very well. But yeah, it's ultimately, I think, one of the reasons that Loki, despite the fact that he goes around murdering a lot of people, is so successful as a character.
Definitely. So the final thing on our list of how to make your character likeable in narrative terms, don't info dump.
Yeah.
I'm going to say don't info dump a lot this episode, probably, but basically, it's okay to tell certain things, but you should be trying to show why your character is likable as much as possible. And a big chunk of text that just says, and they did this, they did this, they did this, you know, that's nobody's invested in your character yet. Nobody's invested in your writing yet. So why would anyone want to read that?
Yeah. I mean,
it's like that's backstory for you.
Yeah, bad enough to have any kind of info dump. But if you just have info dump in order to try and make people like your character, it's not going to work because they're not going to actually engage with your character as a person. They will just be a concept. And ultimately, what you want them to do is engage with them as a person, to see them, to meet them, to make their own judgments.
So as an example, I don't know if you remember the furore a few years ago when Handbook for Mortals was carefully sort of ordered at all these different book outlets so that it knocked Angie Thomas's The Hate You Give off the top spot for the New York Times bestseller.
I did not know about that, but go on.
It was a big thing. Handbook for Mortals is indie published, self-published, and there's nothing wrong with that. I read the free sample,
mm-hmm.
And the main character is introduced as being girl next door, but has three colours in her hair. She's a free spirit. She likes to read tarot cards, etc., etc., etc. This is all you get in the first chapter. She doesn't think she's pretty. This is what she thinks of herself. It is literally almost a chapter-long info dump about what this person is.
Right.
So if I hadn't have already been thoroughly put off actually reading the rest of the book, that would have done it.
Yes. The best way to get to know a character is to see them in action, to see them doing their day-to-day, because it's a little bit like on the on the date thing, on the dating scene. If you have, you know, if you're online dating and you read someone's profile, you still want to go, you know, you still want to have a conversation with them before you know who they really, really are. Just reading information about them isn't going to tell you that much. And it's always that warning sign, which is if you're on a date, look at how they treat the waiter and the staff, or look at how they treat animals or things like that, because that'll be a good indication of the kind of person that they are, even if they're very kind to you. So we as humans, we really learn about one another by seeing how they behave and how they react to certain things. It's exactly the same in a book. Show them in action. Tell us about this character by showing us what they do. So, Gregory Maudsley, sorry to jump back onto The King's Knight, but it's just a great example. We get to know who Gregory Maudsley is, not because it says he was a bullied child, and actually secretly he likes to stand up for those who are being bullied, but by actively showing him having that internal debate within himself, very, very briefly, of do I help this child, do I not, you know, and through that kind of small moment of do I not, and then he does, we learn so much more about him than if we just had pages and pages of information. We learn that this is a guy who wants to be as small as possible, which is hilarious because he's humongous. Yeah. He doesn't want to get involved with things. He doesn't want the trouble. He just kind of wants everything to sort of go away. And at the same time, he has something very small inside of him that still wants to do right, which he's crushed down, but which still has a loud voice, which gets amplified by certain characters, obviously, in the narrative, until he becomes the character that he is by book three. So we see so much more in the way that he acts than if we had just been told all of this information. It's also a little bit like repeatedly being told that someone is a deadly assassin and never actually seeing them kill anybody.
It's like Madeline's just reading out of my bumper book of things that really bug me.
And today...
today on stuff that really, really irritates Jules. This takes us quite nicely onto agency versus control. Versus control. Your character should make choices that affect the narrative and the through line of the book.
Yeah.
And the story. And I think, I mean, Madeline was just obviously talking about Gregory again, and I'm going to get off the King's Knight in a moment, but basically Gregory's decision to help people, however grudgingly, meant that he ended up developing relationships which then shaped both his narrative arc and the through line of the story and who he became as a person. You know, so that is agency, his choice to do something.
Sorry, it's just the movie's like, which therefore means he develops relationships, and you just see Gregory going, ugh, relationships.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Kind of like you'll never get a nice word out of him, but it'll be kind of like, yes, but I probably will die for you. So don't mistake the idea that agency means the character is always in control of everything.
Yeah.
That's not the same as agency. Agency is the character making a choice in reaction to what is happening, rather than the choices being made for her or him or them. You can have situations where outside influences can control almost everything, but your main character can still have agency. I'm bringing up The Hunger Games now because I've seen a lot of shade thrown at a story of songbirds and snakes,
mm-hmm.
Which is the prequel, which honestly I thought was pretty good, and I thought it was an interesting read, and I think it's one of those ones that's going to come back around again and people are going to go, oh, that's what she meant. Which is what's largely happened with The Hunger Games, strangely enough. But they were saying that, you know, at least the young Coriolanus Snow had agency, which Katniss didn't.
Yeah.
And I find this an amazingly obtuse viewpoint because, yes, everything happens to Katniss, but she is forced to make choices every single step of the way.
Yeah.
So you can't say that she doesn't have agency. She doesn't have control of the entire narrative. Of course she doesn't. She's a 16-year-old girl who's been told to fight in an arena against her peers for her life.
Yeah.
But she makes choices, so she definitely has agency.
She does. Interestingly enough, I'm actually going to talk a little bit about fairy tales this regard. So Little Red Riding Hood, a lot of people talk about, you know, Little Red Riding Hood, and I'm talking about the Grimm's version here, or Perrault's version, where ultimately you have Little Red Riding Hood, the wolf is meant to be the bad guy, and when people read it, they say, a lot of them say that Little Red Riding Hood doesn't have agency. And interestingly enough, in Little Red Riding Hood, the one who grants Red agency is the wolf, which I always think is kind of interesting because, you know, he's always like, he granted her agency. He's the bad guy, though. And in the Grimm's version, you have, and I think this is also why the Grimm's version is also more enjoyable than Perrault's version, is that Little Red Riding Hood, she actually gets given agency by the wolf because she's given a choice. And she makes a decision, which is that I'm not going to go straight to my grandmother's house. I'm not going to obey my mother. I'm actually going to go and look at the flowers and do my own thing for a little while. This obviously has ramifications. Now, in the Perrault version, that's very much, this has ramifications, the end, never disobey your parents kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas in the Grimm's version, there is a an epilogue where one day Red meets another wolf, and now again she has agency because she has learned her lesson from the last time. And it's not once again that she's therefore obeying her mother, it's that she has made a decision based on the experiences of the past. Her decision then is to go straight to her grandmother's house and tell her grandmother exactly what's happening, and then the two of them team up to defeat this wolf on their own. I really like that. I think that that is ultimately what makes this particular version of the fairy tale much more engaging, because she has agency and we see her with agency.
Yeah, definitely. It's really, I mean, if without going down a fairy tale rabbit hole, which wouldn't be difficult, it's the idea of who is writing for whom and what they're really trying to achieve. And Perrault is obviously moralising quite a lot, whereas the Brothers Grimm, yeah, there'll be some moralising coming in, but a lot of it was adapting tales that are already existent and may have been hundreds of years old.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was handed down folk wisdom.
Yes, absolutely. Which, again, makes it much more engaging, full stop. Putting that out there.
Okay, let's look at main characters versus side characters, as in what do you need to do for a side character that you don't for a main character, and vice versa.
Yes. We live in a world where it's actually, I think it's easier to make side characters more engaging than main characters.
I think that's just because you always go for the side
characters. That's because the side characters are more engaging than the main characters. No,
there you go. This is a chicken and egg conversation, isn't it?
I think it's ultimately because actually with side characters, people tend to be a little bit more experimental.
Yeah, that's a fair point. You don't need to establish narrative likability so quickly with side characters. It's not their story. So in theory, you've got more time, even if you've got less page time for them.
Also, the other thing is that when you are meeting the main character, it's just you and the main character, you know, who are building up a relationship. Once you've built up a relationship with the main character, you are then experiencing, you know, their introductions to other characters through them, which also makes the pathway easier, I think. So rather than it just being you and them, you and trying to build up a relationship with the main character, you then have the main character building up a relationship with side characters. And the way that the main character and the side character have that relationship between them will very much inform your feelings toward this side character as well. So it is an easier pathway.
Yeah, definitely. It's the difference between walking a trail that hasn't been broken at all with the main character and a trail that has already been broken. It's a little bit easier going, as Madeline says.
Yeah.
So a good example is probably, don't laugh at me, is A Court of Thorns and Roses, where we like Lucien because of how he interacts with Feyre, even though we don't like Feyre and she's dumb as a box of rocks. And, you know, that doesn't mean that Lucien's like this perfect guy or anything. He's really not. But the way he is willing to put himself out for her makes us like him a little bit.
Do not get me on this pathway. You will not like me if you get me on this pathway.
I don't know. I think it's the same. I mean, I've had people saying, oh, can you write more about so-and-so who, you know, sort of turns up a few times and Unveiled or whatever. I love this character. This is great. And what it's clearly that I've gone near an archetype in a way that they really, really engage with.
Yeah.
And that's great. Obviously, it's not their story, so I can't just let them walk in and completely take over, because that's Mary Sue territory right there. But the good thing is, when you... In fact, I'm going to wait, because we've got another little section. I was about to go off on a tangent there, but we'll wait and we'll do it in order. But yeah, basically, it's a similar process. Don't info dump. You can do many of the same steps as you would for creating a likeable, in narrative terms, main character. And you will get people to connect with them in that respect.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I said, you do have a slightly easier job because Jules' analogy of going down the beaten path is very apt there, I think.
Yeah, particularly if this, you know, especially if we're looking at from the position of you're a new writer or new to somebody, new to a reader, as in they've never read your work before and you need to get them on board.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. That's not... if you're starting from a position of they've read some of your books and they already really like the way you write, then you've got an easier task than someone who's never been encountered by them before.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so why... This is what I nearly got onto. Why spend time developing side characters? I mean, surely they just turn up as appendages to the main characters.
How dare you?
Yeah. We know I don't think that. I have books that attest to the fact that I don't think that. I think this is the thing, because depending on how long what you're writing is, it's going to depend how much time you can invest in expanding on a side character. And, you know, how much effort you're going to put in. And you have to be quite careful how you do it as well. On the other hand, I always feel that every character, no matter how small, should feel like a real person.
Yeah.
They shouldn't feel like this is the main character and all the life of the story is with them and this person over here is just a cardboard cutout.
Yeah, that's not enjoyable for anybody concerned.
No. Well, reasons to develop your side characters. As Madeline has demonstrated, not everyone will like your main character, no matter how likeable you make them. So investing in side characters gives you more tasty, tasty bait for your hook.
Yeah, absolutely. It also just makes your book more widely available for a larger number of readers. It's as simple as that, because I have read series where I am reading the series for the side character who is barely in it. Not going to lie, that's exactly what's happening.
In fairness, Madeline and I, before we got recording today, were talking about a particular series of books, which I might have just mentioned, and how we're largely just reading them now because we're invested in some of the side characters.
Yeah, absolutely. We have to know what happens to them. And we're worried.
We're very, very concerned. There have been worrying signs. good side characters will enrich a story. So, you know, while you have to be careful not to unbalance the load, a good side character who's developed, even if they don't have much page time, mm-hmm. will make the story run that much more smoothly. And, you know, I guess it's kind of like having an actor on a stage and asking them to carry an entire play by themselves with people who had basically just, you know, literally carved out of MDF or something, you know, with painted faces, instead of having real actors for them to interact with.
Yeah.
That was a very weird image. I'm sorry about that.
No, it's okay. It just makes me think about poor Ian McKellen doing The Hobbit with all the CGI and just how upset he was about the whole thing, which I can appreciate. But yeah, absolutely, you're right. You need to have, in order to make your main character compelling non-stop, they need to be able to actually have realistic and engaging interactions with other people. And so those other people have to be realistic and engaging and interesting as well. Otherwise, people are just not going to be able to connect with any of the characters, because the world seems fake and unreal. That's not to say, you know, for some people you can have sort of placeholder characters like Innkeeper, who just sort of takes, you know, takes them to their room in one, you know, one shot. You don't necessarily have to have the entire backstory of, you know, the innkeeper. You don't need to know what the innkeeper's finances are unless it's part of the story. But, you know, making them have their own voice, it does benefit your story very, very much. It's just, yeah, it's just better. Honestly, it really is.
Definitely. Although, I will say that I keep saying you shouldn't overbalance the load. And that is the case of, as Madeline sort of just touched on, if you, let's say you've got what a waiter coming in one scene, you're not then going to give his entire backstory or, yeah, as you say, the account book of the innkeeper, because you don't actually need it. And the thing is, if you build up a character to that extent, then your audience is going to be really confused when they don't ever appear in the book again.
Yeah, because they're like, but weren't they important? We got this whole backstory about them. Like, no, they weren't important.
It's sort of the opposite problem to writing a mystery novel and then not introducing the person who has actually done it at some point during the book where there was a chance the reader could pick up on it. You can't say, oh, yes, well, it was the butler who has never been on page, kind of thing. That's, again, cheating your reader.
Yeah, butler who's never been on page or even mentioned. It was the butler. Yes. We have a butler?
Well, yes, how did you think all these teeth you've got in here?
This is very Poirot. We have servants? I never realised. I thought it was just magic.
So, other reasons to have decent side characters, they may change the direction of a story or even of a series.
Yes.
I'm looking at you, Lucas. I'm looking at you. You were supposed to turn up in one book and then disappear. Instead, thanks to Matt, you completely changed the Unveiled series.
I think, like, Cuthbert and Chaucer did the same in King's Knight.
Yeah, although admittedly that was a lot more deliberate. That wasn't sort of like, oh, there's this character and we're going to have him in one book and then they're not going to be mentioned again.
Well, I mean, Chaucer was only supposed to be a cameo in the first book.
He was. He was, and then he was so popular, I was kind of like, I've got to put him on all the other books now. Everyone's like, I love Chaucer. Okay. Guess he's going back then. Yeah, that was a real hardship for me, writing Chaucer.
Oh, no, how awful.
I know, terrible. I love Chaucer. I loved every minute I spent with Chaucer. other things. They may spawn books of their own.
Yes.
I'm very guilty of this, clearly. She said, writing a 15... No, length-long series of a side character from the Unveiled series.
I love that you put the number there and were like, oh no! People can never know.
I don't want them to know until they're invested. It's the hook thing again. Come, take my tasty, tasty bait.
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean, because I'm so guilty of that as well. But also, you're really guilty of doing it. Jules is especially guilty of doing it, and I'm especially guilty of enabling Jules to do it. Whereby I'm like, I love Cuthbert, give me more Cuthbert. And Jules is like, but you know, he's only in this part of the story. He can't just derail the whole story. Give me Cuthbert. All right, I'll write Cuthbert's book. I'll write...
That's not what happened. What happened was, I'll write this 5,000 short story. And then, okay, well, I guess it's more of a novella. And then it's like, Madeline, you're getting a novel for your birthday. I hope you like it.
I read it so many times.
I know, you definitely got mileage out of it. It was a
I really was well did, because I would finish it and then go back to the beginning and reread it again. I loved it so much. So yes, you're allowed to do that. And the good thing is that you want to basically also ensure that your side characters have the capacity whereby, you know, they conceivably could have their own story.
Yeah, definitely.
And I should also point out that their story might not be anything to do with the main character's story in your book either.
Yeah, absolutely. I think sometimes that's where I come a little bit unstuck on some of the young adult fantasy that gets published now.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't a slur on it, because I admit I'm guilty of really relishing subplots that are done well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, side characters are in their own right subplot. So I feel sometimes that the side characters are a bit thin, as in I don't feel I could follow them off on an adventure.
Yeah.
You know, they'd sort of dissolve in the rain kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I do appreciate that lots of people like the easier, more open, accessible nature of some young adult fantasy. They don't necessarily want lots of subplot. They don't necessarily want super complicated side characters.
Yeah.
I just really like a little disclaimer on books saying this has a more linear plot, so I can just like not read it. Kind of thing. Clearly, this is my problem.
I think I have been in situations where I've been discouraged from including things which I wanted to include, because it was like, well, okay, but you're sort of going off on a bit of one now, and I'm like, but I want to have a whole story. I want to tell them their story as well. It's important to the plot, I swear.
I think the thing is, if it does support the plot, even if it makes the book a bit longer, as long as the structure is sound, then I don't see why you can't have it. I'll admit I'm an enabler on this one.
You are.
And if someone says to me, well, if you do that, that means that some readers are not going to find it accessible, then my answer is usually, in that case, I'm not writing for those readers. They're clearly not my target audience, because if you ask me to gamble on my readers' intelligence, I will always gamble on them being intelligent enough to follow me.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, for me, it enriches it. My problem is when you have too many side characters, and I am looking at you, George R. R. Martin.
I was thinking that. And I'm like, it's almost like virtual reality, isn't it? You're kind of immersed in this rich world. But if you really want to get from A to B in a story, that's not necessarily the place you'd go for it.
Well, the thing is that stories like that, you then find yourself in the position of saying, okay, it's absolutely fine to have engaging side characters. Just don't forget your main characters. You know, the people who your readers are actually there for.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think it's like reading a history of Westeros, isn't it? You're not necessarily reading a series of stories. You're reading the history of Westeros as it's happening.
Yeah.
Which is quite a ballsy style decision, and I don't think he would have got away with it if he hadn't been an established author.
I think you might be right, but I think that ultimately, actually, it's holding him back now.
Well, it has become a bit of a problem, because the winds of winter are blowing past. You know, there's no sign of that book. And, that, you know, people are getting pissed off. It's like Patrick Rothfuss as well, the third book in that series. People are getting annoyed because I think readers start to get annoyed if, you know, you are writing a series that they understand that it might take you a year or two between books.
Yeah.
If you're writing particularly epic fantasy. But if they have to wait 5 years and there's no news, and then suddenly it's 10 years, and the years go by very fast.
Yeah, and I think the other problem is that because there was a series that went along with Game of Thrones, which didn't particularly end very well.
Yeah.
A lot of people have sort of given up because they were like, well, you know, I'm not going to read all of this for that payoff. But yeah, then again, I think some people will read it because they want to see some kind of improvement.
Yeah, I mean, it's a 700 or 800 page book per book usually.
Yeah.
Game of Thrones and things like Wheel of Time, and that's asking a lot of readers. That's asking a lot of investment. I mean, I feel bad about having this really long series, but so far no book has been more than 90,000 words.
Yeah,
which is less of an investment time-wise, and I think they're fairly like quick and accessible.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm not churning out 700 or 800 page books and then saying, yeah, this is only a third of the way into the story.
Yeah.
Or in Robert Jordan terms, they've only just got to the end of the road and it's just about tea time. <You know? laughs>
They've reached the garden gate and now it's time to go back indoors. Yeah.
And I love a big chunky book, particularly a big chunky epic fantasy, but I want to feel that I've read a whole story after I've got to the end of 900 pages, and yeah. I don't feel that's too much to ask.
Yeah. So, yes. So,
anyway, we've gone off on a bit of a tangent there. Let's look at characters, very briefly, in fact, characters who took over or demanded more of a voice in our own work.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to come out and say Zachary.
I was going to say, if you hadn't said it, I would have said Zachary. I'm glad he came forward and demanded more of a voice, because I didn't really get to know him in the first book.
Yeah, absolutely. Writing from Zachary's point of view, it just made sense in book two. It just made sense because it said, okay, I want to see what's happening in Hamartia. And Zachary was the obvious person to kind of see it from, also because he represented that opposite side. And he did have a complicated relationship with Rufus. And then getting to know him, it was an incredible journey, actually. And I suddenly like, oh, you're not a side character. You are a main character.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
You're supposed to be in the limelight. It did make a big difference.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it did. And, it sort of opened up the world a little bit more. I think you were right to keep it to the main characters you had in the first book.
Yeah.
Because you're not immediately bombarding us with a dozen different points of view or anything. And then in the second book, when you're already established, then opening it up and giving you Zachary's point of view as well really worked.
Yeah, and we also then have Varen as well, who's coming in, which I think a lot of people were like, who the hell is this guy?
I just really liked Varen, so I was kind of like, yeah, cool, I'm on board. I'm down.
Yeah, and it was also nice to have a few sections from Luca's point of view as well, but yeah, certainly book two introduces a lot of characters, but it's carried very much on the back of characters who are already established. And yeah, having Zachary step forward and become a main character, didn't expect it when I wrote the first book, and it did change the course of the story. For it to become what it has today, for it to be a tale not just about kind of, one particular family, but for it to be a cautionary tale about actually, essentially it's one giant metaphor for an eye for an eye leaves the world blind.
Yeah.
And that you cannot run from the past or the future, but you can learn from the past in order to navigate the future. That is ultimately what it's about. And without Zachary being part of that narrative, considering Zachary's whole story arc in the first book was all about trying to correct the mistakes of the past, quite literally. his whole story, therefore that piece completely changed the whole dynamic of Rufus's story and Rufus's development. Because Rufus's story could have very much been about doing the exact same thing that Zachary had tried to do in book one, which would be to correct the mistakes of the past. But that's not what his story is about. It's about creating balance now. Yes, trying to retake Hamartia, get rid of Sferin, to undo this atrocity which has been committed. But he's also looking forward and saying, actually, there have been wrongs on both sides, and if we continue this cycle of revenge, this conflict is never going to end. So even if it personally injures me, I have got to be the one who ends this cycle.
Okay, characters who demanded a voice in my work. More of a voice, rather. Obviously, Amy.
Yes.
And since Amy now has her entire new series, she should be happy. Also, Kieran, actually.
Yay!
He was not happy to just stay in the background as a love interest at all. So he ended up having an entire book of his own and then splitting the narration of the sixth book.
Yes.
With M. And I think that worked. But I kind of feel that, I mean, having written the collection of stories Dead Roads,
mm-hmm.
I think I've got something from almost everyone's point of view in there.
Yeah, absolutely. The one thing that always got me was that with Dead Roads and stuff like that, I was like, you've got this character, you've got this character, you've got this character. We see from Craig's point of view, there's, you know, you've written stuff from Kelsey's point of view, you've written stuff from Kieran's point of view, you know, the whole gang. And then obviously you started writing from Amy's point of view, and I was like, what have we never seen from Steve's point of view? And now I know. You cheeky booger.
You will learn, you will find out. There will be more.
Okay, here's a question then for you, before we sign off, because I'm very interested to know. Are there any characters currently who you feel tempted to explore a little bit more on the side? Who you're like, actually, I kind of want to see them go off and have their own adventure kind of thing, but you haven't done it yet?
It's always a temptation. I think I kind of want to look a little bit more at Rebecca's backstory, but that might be coming up in another book.
Yeah.
I'm saying Rebecca and nobody else except you knows who I'm talking about. Sorry, this is Harker and Blackthorn. She's one of the main characters from that. And, you know, they will start being released in July this year, so
yeah,
you'll eventually know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Of the others. It's like, I've written from Grace's point of view in Unveiled, and I like writing from her point of view, but in terms of a supernatural storyline, which is essentially what I'm catering people for,
mm-hmm.
she's quite limited because, you know, she doesn't like the supernatural and she doesn't have the touch, so she's kind of like, is this a story about someone who's kind of like, yes, I'm living in this lovely mundane world, oh god, not again, kind of.
It's like, I'm living in this lovely mundane world, a zombie comes out of the cupboard, she shoves it back in, lovely mundane world.
I've really, really enjoyed having her and Nick and Kieran sort of all make cameos in Harker and Blackthorn.
Yes.
It's been lots of fun.
Yeah, it's been very, very good.
What about you?
What about me? I've given in to temptation a lot, so... I know that at one point it would be really, really nice to explore Varen's story. Varen, Isaac and Beatrice... and see their kind of little tale. Something else I really want to explore is I want to look at Torin when he was younger, particularly his friendship with Eren, and how he ended up fathering Rufus, because there's a whole story there. You know, I'd be very interested to see him as a youth, to explore him as a youth, I think would be very, very good. In Kestrel, all of the characters. I just want to see all of the characters. And I have already kind of played around with little short stories. Definitely there has been stuff from Aaron's point of view. He's my detective. And Sammy is my psychic. He will definitely have his own little stories at some point because he's just too... he's too adorable to leave alone. But also my other characters of Shaylin and Jen, who I'm not going to go into too much detail about those two, but I think at some point whilst I'm writing the series, there will be books from all of their points of view as they go off on their own sort of adventures, because there's just so much possibility. But I have to rein myself in.
Yes, write the main series first.
Yes, Jules.
Although, in fairness to Madeline, I'm not helping her with the whole skipping all around the place thing because I keep sort of like nudging the Melanie Beckett series a bit closer. And, you know, that there are cameos from Kestrel, not Kestrel herself, but characters from the Kestrel series that turn up in Harker Blackthorne as well. So
yes, yes.
And I'm writing way on from the timeline from Kestrel as well. So.
It's really fun because I just feel like I'm writing Kestrel and then it's like, and now 8 years in the future.
This is happening. But we don't know how Kestrel ends. No, but we're just going to throw it out there. Wing and a prayer.
You're going to see what happens. Have to sort of kind of move around some huge central plots and moments, which are, yeah. But the best thing has been the cameos, writing the cameos, where I keep putting cameos in Kestrel for Harker and Blackthorne and stuff like that, and then I'm like, oh no, wait, this is 8 years before. Does this even make sense? Jules, were these people around 8 years ago?
Yeah. It's like, yeah, I think they would have been around, definitely. And then you talk about, it's like, well, it's like Amy would be about 13, so that might be a bit of an issue kind of thing. I know who else I've got. I mean, Harker and Blackthorne, without going into too much detail, the company Harker and Blackthorne are cryptid investigators and they go back to the Victorian era. And I desperately, desperately want to write Harker and Blackthorne Origins, which tells the story of the original Harker and Blackthorns, because there's all these diary entries and things that are sort of peppered through the series, mm-hmm. From various people on Steve and Rebecca's family trees.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's like, okay, they feel like they might be really compelling characters in their own rights. And I'm so tempted to kind of just follow them. No, not until this series is complete.
Behave, Jules, behave.
I will be strong.
Right. I think... we have reached the end of our episode. Hopefully it's all made sense. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation. And this week, I have a slightly weird one for you.
Okay.
So I'm actually, for the second time, going to recommend a YouTube channel. This is called Jaden's Animations. This is a very, you know, an easy watching feel-good series about just Jaden. She does her own animations. She covers all sorts of topics. She's a massive nerd. So, she has animated a couple of her Nuzlocke Pokemon playthroughs, challenges, and other things like that. She has a bird called Ari, who appears in her videos as well. The animation is smooth, it's fun, good sense of humour, really kind of easy, fun thing to watch and appreciate as well, because she just seems like a nice, well-rounded, rather sweet person. So actually really, really enjoyable if you kind of just want to watch something light and fun and very well animated. So that is my recommendation. Check out Jaden Animations.
Oh, cool. That sounds good.
And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening. Do get in touch with us and tell us who your favourite side characters and main characters are. What made you fall in love with them? And have there been characters you've been engaged with who you've actually thought are really terrible? Let us know. Remember, you can get in contact with us via Facebook, Tumblr, or Twitter, both individually and through our Dissecting Dragons pages. For now, we'll say stay safe, everybody, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.